Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got Frances Welsh talking about the Imperial Tea Party.
Hi, thank you for coming. Can you hear with all, does the mic work all right? Yes, you can hear, good. Okay, anyway, so here's the first picture. The talk is all about the relationship between the Russian royal family, the Romanovs, and the British royal family, and here they are. Nobody looks particularly jolly in this picture, but the two families, that is, the Romanovs and the British royal family, certainly appear close. Alexis and Anastasia both look like they're cozying up to their great-uncle Bertie. There they are in the front. King Edward VII, that is. The 10-year-old Maria is leaning against her cousin Georgie. That's on that side. He has his arm around her. This picture was taken during the Imperial family's visit to England in August 1909. They're outside what is now the kitchen window of Barton Manor, next to Osborne House on the Isle of Wight. Today, I'll be taking a look behind the scenes, examining just how loving and together the Romanovs and the British royal family actually were. I will be examining three of their surprisingly few meetings, meetings that were in fact suffused with tensions and awkwardnesses, and perhaps even a sense of the threat that lay ahead. And while the cousins are frequently at the centre of the scenarios, George V was the first cousin to both the Tsar and the Tsarina. Many of the difficulties revolve around the prickly interaction between their two entourages. Perhaps it all harks back to an abiding clash in the relationship between Russia and Britain. I've always been intrigued by that relationship. All the books I've written about the imperial family, it's the Russian imperial family, have had vital British links. My first was a biography of the Romanov children's English tutor, Sidney Gibbs, who came from Rotherham. Another, The Russian Court at Sea, followed the rescue of 17 Romanovs from Yalta in 1919 on the British battleship Marlborough. I unearthed British connections even to my last book, a short biography of Rasputin. In 2007, I interviewed Kirill Zinoviev, then 104 and the last person alive to have actually seen Rasputin in St. Petersburg. Kirill Zinoviev lived in Chiswick, and the interview was in Chiswick. And I've always been riveted by that Isle of Wight visit, the only trip to Britain made by the Tsar, Tsarina, and all their five children. And the other two meetings I'll be describing today, and I describe in the book, took place at Balmoral in 1896, before most of the children were born, and at Reval, which is now Tallinn in Estonia. Why the Isle of Wight? Well, the main reason would have been security. It was considered the only place where the Tsar could be adequately protected. The imperial family were permitted just 3 nights and 2 full days in British waters. The Tsar was based on the imperial yacht Standart and barely allowed to set foot on British soil. The fiery Labour leader, Keir Hardie, who hated them, announced at the time that he was glad that their contamination, in quotes, was restricted to cows and that the yacht would be guarded, in quotes, like a plague spot. The autocratic Russian Tsars, hold on a second, had been massively unpopular among left-wing factions in Britain for decades. They had a terrible record on human rights and censorship, and Tsar Nicholas had proven little better than his predecessors. For all his apparently mild manner, he was reluctant to carry out reforms. He was wholly committed to the divine right of kings, even if his bear-like father had once called him girly when he was a child. There were protests and serious threats of assassinations before all three of the meetings I'll be describing, and all were dogged by elaborate and absolutely essential security. And as I started researching this book, I found a gratifying pattern emerging. While the authorities struggled with dissidents, revolutionaries, and terrorists, the royal parties grappled with minor grievances. The more I read of the dangers, the more captivated I became by the inability of the royal parties to get beyond niggles and social niceties to the important issues, issues of survival that were so vital. During the Balmoral meeting, that was the one in 1896, the imperial couple, that's Nicholas and Alexandra, both complained about the incessant rain, and the Tsar succumbed to toothache. At Reval, there were grumbles from the British party about the Russian food and balalaika music. At the Isle of Wight, the Tsar and Georgie, the future George V, devoted most of their pedantic diary entries to chronicling the weather, which was usually breezy. The current Earl Spencer kindly sent me his great-grandfather's unpublished diary. The sixth Earl Spencer was then Lord Chancellor, dancing attendance on King Edward VII, that's Bertie. But the Earl's entries are equally unenlightening. His general air, especially regarding the Russians' efforts at hospitality, was one of mild complaint, poor service, poor food, and poor music. It is this extraordinary dissonance between etiquette and revolution which lies at the heart of the Imperial Tea Party. The Balmoral visit of 1896 was preceded by unsettling rumours of a so-called dynamite conspiracy in which the Tsar would be blown up. And here's a very short reading about the security for Balmoral, which preceded the visit to Balmoral. Courtiers liaised with the Metropolitan Police and the Aberdeenshire Constabulary. The Constabulary, in turn, were in daily contact with Continental Police. Hundreds of plainclothes policemen would work alongside 24 constables and four sergeants from the Metropolitan Police. The movements of the Tsar's secret police, the Okhrana, however, remained a mystery. Clues seldom went beyond rumours of bodyguards secreting themselves behind bushes armed with spyglasses. One Metropolitan Police report later revealed slightly more detail, and this is a quote. Three Russian detective officers present, now residing with head gardener to Her Majesty the Queen. But 2 weeks before the visit, the equerry was writing a coy note to the private secretary, who was called Arthur Bigg. And the equerry wrote, from a remark I heard dropped at the Russian embassy, I fancy the two persons who are to live in the artists' rooms at Balmoral are Russian police. So you can see all the covert doings and plans going on. It was deemed too dangerous for the Tsar even to pass through London as he travelled south to Portsmouth after the visit. In the 1890s, the city was home to several prominent Russian revolutionaries, taking advantage of Britain's famously lax security. Not least, the extravagantly bearded Prince Peter Kropotkin, who was stirring up trouble from his home in Bromley. And there he is. Kropotkin lived relatively near the anarchist Mikhail Bakunin, who lived in Paddington Green. Bakunin, in turn, had once lived almost alongside Karl Marx in Kentish Town. 6 years later, Lenin himself was living briefly in Pentonville. There, he was visited by Trotsky, who arrived speaking no English, but had Lenin's address written in pencil on a piece of paper. It was Lenin's wife who paid the cab fare. Now, the 11-day visit to Balmoral took place from Tuesday, September the 22nd, to Saturday, October the 3rd, 1896. Here is Alexandra, the future Tsarina, at Balmoral 4 years before the visit in 1892. After the death of her mother when she was only six, she was informally adopted by Queen Victoria. The closeness of the fond grandmother and her German-born granddaughter may not have been altogether beneficial. The English tutor, Mr. Gibbs, who I mentioned that I wrote a biography of, certainly believed that the Queen had had a bad influence on the young Alexandra. He claimed that the Queen had been behind what he called the Tsarina's lack of theatricality. It was this inability to emote that had made her so unpopular in her adopted country. The Russians, Gibbs claimed, liked to act out their lives. At one point, the Queen had tried to fix Alexandra up with Georgie's elder brother, Prince Albert, the Duke of Clarence, who was known for being feckless and homosexual. And there had been a sort of courtship at Balmoral, but Alexandra, perhaps unsurprisingly, rejected him. The truth was that Nicholas and Alexandra had been fascinated with each other ever since she was only 12. Queen Victoria initially disapproved. She disliked Russians generally, particularly Nicholas's father, the massive Alexander III, who was rumoured to walk through doors without opening them. She dismissed him as an Asiatic barbarian. Fortunately, her disapproval did not extend to the young Tsarevich, Nicholas. For all her Russophobia, she had always liked Nicky. And of course, she soon came round to the match. Her volte-face is illustrated here. She held a party to celebrate Nicholas and Alexandra's wedding. It is dated 26th of November, 1894. The date in Russia was, in fact, 14th of November. the Russian Julian calendar then being 12 days behind the Western Gregorian calendar, which we used. Though it's seldom referred to directly, the different dates would certainly have presented challenges to any Anglo-Russian endeavours. And here we are, oh, hang on a second, sorry, I'm going to have a bit more water. Here we are, nearly 2 years later, in 1896. The newly built imperial yacht, Standart, is there, is caught at Copenhagen on her first voyage to Edinburgh. The departure was delayed as the yacht underwent finishing touches. The change in the arrival date upset Queen Victoria, who complained of great inconvenience. Huffy telegrams, which all exist in the Royal Archive, ricocheted back and forth between Victoria's equerry and the Russian naval attaché. Along with the new arrival date, there were last-minute proposals to change docks. The exasperated equerry grumbled that the Russians combined endless requests for changes in the arrangements with a reluctance to supply vital information. The Tsar was met at Leith by Bertie, the future Edward VII. In a diplomatic gesture, the two men had exchanged uniforms, so the Tsar was wearing a Scots Greys uniform and Bertie was dressed as a Kiev dragoon. And here's the Tsar in his Scots Greys outfit at Balmoral a few days later with the Duke of Connaught. The exchange of uniforms never proved popular. Bertie's Russian outfit, Bertie being Edward VII, his Russian outfit never quite fitted, and the nationalist Tsar objected to wearing the wrong uniform. Shortly after his arrival, he was complaining to his mother in a letter, "You will understand how unpleasant it was to have to say goodbye to our officers and crew in a foreign uniform." The greetings between Bertie and the Tsar at Leith would have exposed further problems. There was a personality mismatch between the rumbustious Bertie and the shy Tsar. Bertie dismissed his 28-year-old nephew in private as weak as water. What the Tsarina's attitude to Bertie was at the time is not known, but she can't have been on good form. Ever a martyr to real and imagined maladies, she was at that point recovering from a headache. She'd been obliged to spend the whole of the day before in bed. And the weather, as I said before, was atrocious. Dreich and misty conditions, reported the Scotsman. And as for the actual stay, well, it should have been perfect, a wonderful reunion between the couple and Queen Victoria following a separation of more than 2 years. The trio, that's the couple and Queen Victoria, had spent happy days all together during the couple's engagement at Windsor and the Isle of Wight. But the Tsar immediately found himself embroiled in sodden hunts with the over-energetic Bertie, and he failed to hit anything. As the Tsarina wrote to her in a letter to her governess, Maggie, "My husband has not shot one stag." And Bertie further blotted his copybook with Nicholas by repeatedly bringing up the exhausting topic of an Anglo-Russian agreement. The peaceable Tsar told his mother he must prefer the company of his cousin, Georgie, the future George V, with whom he could discuss holidays in Denmark. On the seventh day, the Tsar was obliged to put on his Scots Greys uniform for this photo. A succession of grim family photos followed, with the Queen, Bertie, the Tsarina, and baby Olga. And here they are. The Tsarina looks nervous and put upon, perhaps recovering from another migraine. The baby Olga is making a face, and the Queen appears to be delivering a rebuke. Bertie looks as though he wishes he were elsewhere, and he did, in fact, leave the party early to nip off to the Newmarket races. Nobody in either sets of photos looks cheery. Alongside the wet and unproductive hunts, the further blow for the Tsar had been endless political conversations, as he called them. At one point, he complained to his mother that there were more demands on his time at Balmoral than there were back in St. Petersburg. Along with Bertie and his Anglo-Russian ideas, there was Granny, as he called Queen Victoria, who could never resist tackling him on the issue of Turkey and the Sultan. It seemed that every time she found herself alone with Nicky, usually in a carriage, she had to give him a grilling. Then finally, there were two exhausting meetings with the Prime Minister, Lord Salisbury. The first meeting went very well, with Salisbury pronouncing Nicholas extremely agreeable. By the time of the second one, however, the impressionable Tsar had changed his views. He tended to agree with whoever he'd last spoken to, and that was usually his wife. In this case, it was his ambassador who he'd seen the night before. The second fraught meeting with Salisbury was conducted hours after this photo was taken, and it was later that evening that the poor Tsar succumbed to his tooth abscess, probably brought on by stress. And here is the seating plan for September the 30th. It shows the Tsar absent on account of his tooth. As he wrote in his diary, "My left cheek swelled up in an ugly fashion." The seating plan belonged to one of the Queen's ladies-in-waiting. Lady Lytton was, at this point, 54 and a former viceroy of India. She was not altogether impressed by the young imperial couple. As she wrote, "Neither of them took the trouble to bow, as the Queen did so well." That evening, she was sitting next to the Queen's private secretary, Arthur Bigg, whose own worry had been the size of the Romanov party, comprising an entourage of several hundred. He would talk grimly of the Russian occupation of Balmoral. Years later, Bigg, by then Lord Stamfordham, would play a central role in the argument after the revolution about whether the Romanovs would be able to come and live in Britain. Okay, so here we go on the last day. Sorry, I might just have a little bit more water. Outside Balmoral. This is actually a still of a moving shot, which you can actually see on YouTube now even. On the last day, the photographers returned to film moving pictures outside the main entrance to Balmoral. The Queen sits in her buggy holding a lively little dog. She would obviously not obey the cameraman's instructions to jump about, because obviously he was trying to get moving pictures. The Tsar has managed to jettison his Scots Greys outfit, but in civvies, he looks even less impressive, like a sort of bank manager. He swings his walking stick in the moving film to give himself an air of insouciance, which doesn't quite work. The Tsarina, as usual, looks ill at ease. She's just there, third from the right. Yeah, third from that side. The Tsar felt increasingly cheerful as he went down south. He doesn't seem to have given a thought to his safety, even though he'd written a letter to a friend from Balmoral saying that he would not be travelling through London for security reasons. He wrote a buoyant note in his diary on his last night in British waters. He was at this point still moored at Portsmouth. "At last they listened to our own music." So, and he was relieved. And then we move on to this is the map depicting the route to Reval for the meeting between Bertie, we've now shunted forward and he's now King Edward VII, and the Tsar. The Reval meeting took place 12 years later on Tuesday, June the 9th and Wednesday, June the 10th, 1908. Before the meeting at Reval, there were more rumours of assassination plots. Indeed, one of the Russian officials in charge of security was a particularly unsavoury-looking double agent. For security reasons, the two-day meeting was to be conducted entirely offshore on board the royal yachts. And here's a tiny bit about the security at Reval from the book. In Reval itself, plans were haggled over at the Katerinenthal Palace as Russian, German and Estonian officials vied for the final say. This jostling for power intensified with the governor of Reval making several failed attempts to bring the Russian navy under his command. All were finally agreed, however, that houses and boats should be minutely searched and that the port would teem with detectives. Hotel managers had to report the arrival of any strangers within an hour. Failure to do so would result in a £3,000 fine. No one without a permit would be allowed through the dock gates. One merchant was even forbidden from sending provisions to the Standard. There would be rigorous stop and search policies. At one point, Bertie's private secretary, the lugubrious looking Frederick Ponsonby, was obliged to step in to protect a group of female serenaders from being strip searched. So that was the security at Reval. Here is Bertie, now back in his ill-fitting Russian uniform. The Russian head of security described the difficulties faced by the increasingly plump king. And this is a quote from him. He was called Alexander Spiridovich. "The tailor from the Standard did what he could to rectify the problem, but was only partly successful, meaning the king, strapped up in his tunic, which was visibly too tight for him, and wearing the little dragoon's cap, appeared far from imposing." That was the Russian's head of security's view. In the background are the two sisters, Queen Alexandra and the Tsar's mother, or the Tsar's mother, the Dowager, is on that side. The sisters were close. The Dowager would no doubt have told her sister about her ongoing problems with her daughter-in-law, the Tsarina, mostly concerning jewels and protocol. The sisters may even then have been discussing the Tsarina as they were there. She had a poor first day at Reval, absenting herself from tea on the royal yacht, the Victoria and Albert, with leg pains. She was later found weeping alone on deck by the former ambassador, Charles Harding. The current ambassador, Arthur Nicholson, was clearly not a fan of the Tsarina. He described her at Reval as a shy and sulky woman. She had the stooping movement adopted by affectionate women who are much taller than their husbands. The whites of her eyes were yellow with prolonged dyspepsia. She pointed at things and people with a lace sunshade. And here's just another picture of King Edward VII. He liked his food. On the first night at Reval, he was bowled over by one of the standout chef's recipes, declaring, "You could," this is the king speaking, "you could eat your own mother with this sauce." Sorry. Imagine Queen Victoria. But Nicholson was not impressed and would clearly not have enjoyed the sauce, especially if it was with or over Queen Victoria. "The food was very bad," he complained. The music that evening proved a further disappointment. Nicholson reported that the king disliked the balalaikas. "He fiddled," this is Nicholson's quote, "he fiddled in an abstract manner with the gold bracelet on his left wrist." Frederick Ponsonby, who I mentioned earlier, complained of, in quotes, "weird Russian songs." As I've already said, Bertie didn't rate the Tsar, but at Reval he did his best to be diplomatic. Even the sceptical Nicholson noted his efforts, insisting that the king made the Tsar feel every bit, and that's in quotes, "the successful nephew." Several Russian diplomats pointed out the Tsar got on better with the British royals than he did with his other cousin, the Kaiser. The Russian party were not, however, all in agreement here. The prickly standout officer, whose memoirs I used quite a lot for the book, it's called Nikolai Sablin, claimed that the king patronised his nephew. He reported that towards the end of that evening, the Tsar was humiliated as he tried and failed to get the king's attention. And here's a third short reading, which is mainly Sablin's quote. Sablin was infuriated as he watched the king talking instead to a random member of the standart crew. And this is Sablin's quote, begins here. "Ministers and other officials gathered around the Tsar, expecting to be summoned to the anticipated informal meeting of the monarchs. The king lit a large cigar, took a seat in one of the chairs near the royal cabins. Suddenly he stood up and slowly walked towards the watchman. Standing to the right of the ladder, Edward VII began animatedly talking to the astonished sailor about something, puffing a fragrant cigar from time to time. Everyone was watching the scene with amazement. The Tsar tried to approach His Majesty several times, but the king pretended not to notice and became even more engaged in conversation. The ministers concluded that no conference would be held, neither today nor in the future, and the king decided without them what was required for the good of England. The king entertained this simple Russian sailor with his conversation for a quarter of an hour." And by the way, the watchman couldn't understand English, so didn't catch a word of what the king said. Sablin added that as the king left the yacht, he handed his new friend a half-smoked cigar. On the second day, there was a lunch on the standart. The king now promoted the Tsar to the rank of British Admiral. This proved controversial as he had not cleared it with the British authorities. The Tsar, in his turn, made Bertie Admiral of the Russian fleet. The Tsar described his fleet as, in quotes, "young and growing." In fact, it comprised just one ship, all the rest having been sunk during the Russo-Japanese War at Tsushima. It was probably over this lunch that the king complained to the Tsarina about the young Grand Duchess's English accents. They were sort of, at that time, sort of 11 and 12 little girls. It was as a result of the criticism that the girl's English tutor was immediately fired to be replaced by Mr. Gibbs, who, as I said, I wrote the biography of. Nicholson, that's the ambassador, had already been rude about the girls, insisting that they giggled incessantly like English schoolgirls. And here is the menu from the second dinner on the Victoria and Albert, all in French, as you can see. And it's dated 10th of June. The standart, which is correct as far as we're concerned, the standart menus, confusingly, were headed with the Julian calendar date. but then the whole Russian contingent was probably also 13 days behind. The Tsar never willingly switched the Gregorian calendar. He was very put out when the Bolsheviks insisted after the revolution that Russia adopt the same calendar as the rest of Europe. After this dinner, the famous Admiral John, or Jackie Fisher, danced with the Tsar's sister Olga before performing an elaborate solo, the hornpipe. Queen Alexandra, the wife of Bertie, obviously, reported slightly sourly that the dancing admiral even succeeded in making the Tsarina smile, which shows you what the Queen thought of her. Here is Olga, Queen of Greece, who was also at Reval, grandmother to our own Prince Philip. Her son married the Tsarina's niece, Alice, who had spent a lot of time with Nicholas and Alexander during their engagement in 1894. And here is the family on the standart. This is where I'm meant to be using my stick, but I've lost it, actually, it doesn't matter. Where I was meant to point out who was who. But anyway, you'll probably know who they all are. That's Maria, little Maria, the third daughter, Anastasia in the middle. I think that's Tatiana and Olga at the back. Although, however closely I look, I'm slightly worried that Olga and Tatiana might be wrong. And then Alexis there, Tsarina and the Tsar. All on the standart anyway. This meeting took place at the Isle of Wight. The meeting took place a year after Reval. And it took place from Monday the 2nd to Thursday the 5th of August, 1909. This picture was taken on the standart 2 months before. During the lead-up to the Isle of Wight visit, objections were raised in Westminster and public calls for the Tsar's assassination discussed in cabinet. Protests had been stirred up by Keir Hardie, who I mentioned earlier. The public was assured, wrongly of course, that the Tsar would remain offshore and not set foot on British soil. But we know, of course, that he did end up going to Barton Manor. And here's a very short reading about the mayhem at the Isle of Wight to try to cope with what they thought was going to be some revolutionaries and dissidents. The countryside around Cowes was indeed swarming with Russian and British police. Patrolling cyclists raced through the leafy lanes while Russian secret agents hung around in pairs, cursorily disguised in yachting caps. Emissaries from Scotland Yard and St. Petersburg were stationed at Southampton, Portsmouth, Lymington and Bournemouth. Visitors arriving at the pierheads of Ryde, Seaview, Sandown, Shanklin, Ventnor, Alum and Totland Bays were scrutinised and some turned away. The island faced unprecedented numbers, some 12,000 visitors arriving over just a couple of days at the Victoria Pier. The county press made the most of the excitement, and this is a quote. The Scotland Yard officers are, of course, fully acquainted with the movements in this country of the Russian and other foreign revolutionaries, and the few few suspects of this connection who arrived at the yachting capital were promptly warned away. And the Isle of Wight Times added, and that's a quote, the local police frankly confess that they have never before had to deal with anything so comprehensive and complete as the scheme of protection for the Tsar, nor do they believe that an organisation to equal it has ever been formed in England. So that's all the mayhem on the Isle of Wight. The family arrived at the Isle of Wight after a long period of sailing. They'd arrived at Reval by train. In theory, the family all loved being on the standart. However, in this photograph, they're all looking a bit glum, and I thought perhaps it was the seasickness that had already kicked in. On their way to the Isle of Wight, all the family, apart from the Tsar, suffered from terrible seasickness. 12-year-old Tatiana, who I think is this one, was particularly susceptible. The crew even created a swinging chair for her, which they hoped would help her. On the other hand, perhaps the reason for their solemnity in this photograph is the presence of the Kaiser. Here he is, holding a sulky-looking Alexis at the end. The Tsar, as I said, was apparently even more uncomfortable with the Kaiser than he was with his uncle Bertie. And then we have a picture of the Tsarina with two ladies there. During the visit, the Tsarina was once again out of sorts, this time suffering from facial neuralgia and sleeplessness, a bit like the Tsar at Balmoral. Here, however, she's managing to smile while she greets two ladies, both of whom look as though they're making efforts to be pleasant. The one on the right looks nervous. As Mr. Gibbs pointed out, as I quoted earlier, the Tsarina generally came across as haughty and stiff. And here is the next, yeah. This is a great photo, I think. This is cheering on the ship, the Lord Nelson. All the sailors from the Lord Nelson are cheering as the Tsar and the King go past. During the afternoon of the first day, the King and the Tsar reviewed the fleet and were cheered by sailors on the British ships. Here are the sailors cheering in regimented fashion on the Lord Nelson. The ceremony was meant to boost British-Russian relations, but it seems to have had the opposite effect. The Russians were upset by the sheer size of the British fleet. 24 battleships, 16 armed cruisers, 48 destroyers, and well over 50 other vessels of war. Several of the standout officers and one Russian admiral complained about the paucity of their own fleet. And the irrepressible Admiral Fisher, who'd been doing the dancing at Revel, couldn't resist driving the point home with a boast to the Tsar. 18 miles of ships and the most powerful in the world and none of them more than 10 years old. So you can imagine how that would have gone down with the Tsar. Donald M. Wallace, a writer who also had been at Balmoral, reported that the Russian foreign minister and most of the Russian diplomats seemed uneasy during the whole of the Isle of Wight visit. This first event cannot have helped. 10 years later, after the revolution, it would be the Lord Nelson, this ship, incidentally, that took 12 surviving Romanovs fleeing Russia from Malta to England. Now, here is the Tsarina and the Queen, or the Queen and the Tsarina, that way around, watching the racing. On their first full day, the children went to the beach. The adults, meanwhile, had a morning of racing. Here are the Tsarina and the Queen sitting next to each other. I said it's actually the other way around, the Queen on the left, whichever, looking grim. Of course, the pair were reputed at the time to be the two most elegant sovereigns in Europe. By the time of the Isle of Wight visit, Rasputin had become a frequent visitor to the Imperial Palace, encouraged by the Tsarina. Her mother-in-law, the Dowager, objected strongly to these visits and would doubtly have expressed her misgivings to her sister, the Queen. Relations between the Queen and the Tsarina would not have been easy. And here are the King and the Queen on the Britannia for an afternoon cruise. The Queen and Edward VII here are also looking a bit stony-faced. The cruise was in fact meant to have been fun, considered delightful, which was a quote, even by the tight-lipped Earl Spencer. It was during this afternoon that the two elder daughters, Olga and Tatiana, then aged 13 and 12, decided to go shopping in West Cowes. And here they are with their Dr. Botkin, who had been working with the family for about a year by that time. And here's just a very small description of them, the girls' progress down the Cowes High Street. Their progress down the High Street was monitored by the Isle of Wight's stalwart Chief Constable Captain H.G. Adams Connor and his Deputy Chief Constable, Mr. Galloway. According to the county press, the policeman, and then in quotes, kept the visitors under observation but did not make their official character known. The girls wore discreet outfits, as you can see, matching grey suits and straw hats, but were unable to tone down their high spirits. The reporter from the county press was rather baffled by their enthusiasm, and this is a quote from the county press. Their Royal Highnesses walked slowly through the main streets of Cowes, inspecting very commonplace shop windows with much eagerness and excitement. And as we progressed through, everybody on the Cowes High Street got more and more excited. And as excitement grew, several ladies pursued the girls into Benz's, the jewellers, and Captain Adams Connor was obliged to stand in the doorway to prevent what the county press now admitted was, in quotes, troublesome homage. It was Scotland Yard Superintendent Quinn who came to the rescue. He and the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Sir Edward Henry, ordered police to line the street and clear a path for the royal party. If the girls earlier gave the impression that they were enjoying themselves, their companions were less convincing. As the county press reported, in quotes, some at least of their attendants were a little perturbed by the whole incident. And I think Dr. Botkin looks perturbed in that picture. Sorry. On the second night, dinner was held on the standart, and there was trouble once again with the music. Earl Spencer disliked the standart's choir, And this is his quote, "Boys sang not very well. He was no happier with the Russian meal." And this is a quote, "Not good food." And here we are, this is the tea tent at Barton Manor, in the grounds of Barton Manor, on the lawns in front of the house. On the second full day, the Imperial family spent their few furtive hours on shore. So they came ashore, after all, visiting Osborne and Barton Manor. They visited Queen Victoria's deathbed, which had been kept exactly as it was when she died. One of the British diplomats reported, unsurprisingly, that the Tsarina became upset every time Victoria was mentioned. The future Edward VIII, then 15, showed them, that's the Romanovs, around Osborne House. He remembered being particularly struck by the Tsarina's sadness. Now, all these subsequent photos were taken during this tea at Barton Manor. And here are Georgie, and, or rather Nikki and Georgie, arms linked. There'd always been jokes about their strong resemblance. Queen Victoria herself had been amused, referring to, and then a quote, "no end of funny mistakes." The Tsar actually found it quite annoying, I think. But anyway, and there is Nikki and Georgie and David, future Edward VIII, and Alexis. And you can see Georgie's hands are resting fondly on Alexis's shoulders. Then, on the last morning, there were the presentations. This cigarette box, depicting the Russian and British naval flags, was given by the Tsarina to one of the British diplomats. The Tsar was known for being overly generous with his presents. The King, in contrast, made it clear in a crisp letter to one of his diplomats that anything like a, this is a quote, "wholesale distribution of medals and gifts never takes place." I think that was probably a dig at the Tsar. The Tsar gave £1,000 to the so-called island poor. £400 was given to Newport. The £600 given to cows became a vexed issue as arguments developed between the councillors about how the cash should be divided between East and West cows. And that's the inscription Alexandra 1909 on the back of the cigarette box. And then there'll be another picture of them all together outside Barton Manor. The Romanovs and British royal family had a farewell lunch on the Standart before waving each other goodbye. The families would never meet again. And 9 years later, the Romanovs would all be shot in a cellar at Ekaterinburg. It was in the early hours of the morning of July the 17th, 1918, that the family were woken up and told that they were to be moved to a safer location. Gathered in the cellar, they were told to line up against a wall for a photograph. The killings lasted a full 20 minutes as bullets ricocheted off the jewels that the young Grand Duchesses had sewn into their corsets. The question lingers as to whether Georgie, by then, of course, King George V, should have given the Romanovs a sanctuary after the revolution. An invitation was issued by the British government to the family, but the invitation was then withdrawn. Who was behind the withdrawal? Though the King was officially responsible for the decision, he was in fact spurred on by his private secretary, Stam Fordham. It was Stam Fordham, you might remember, who had railed against the Russian occupation of Balmoral in 1896, what he called the Russian occupation. Now he pursued a remorseless campaign to keep the Romanovs out. And so there was a sort of exchange of letters between Stam Fordham and the Foreign Office. There were decades, however, when neither the King nor Stam Fordham were held to account. The finger pointed at the government generally and at the Prime Minister Lloyd George in particular. Lloyd George made no effort to avoid being blamed. He especially rewrote the relevant chapter in his autobiography. The Russian ambassador, Sir George Buchanan, was said to have falsified his account, partly to save his Foreign Office pension. In an interview as late as 1971, I was going to say that's quite recent. Actually, it's not recent, is it? Anyway. Seems it to us. Mountbatten was still blaming Lloyd George. And this is what Mountbatten said in an interview. He was the son of the Tsarina's sister, Victoria. So he was the Tsarina's nephew. And he said, "Oh yes, in the early days, the King discussed it with my mother," that's the Tsarina's sister, The king was very anxious to offer them asylum over here, but the government, the Prime Minister, Lloyd George, was understandably opposed on political grounds at the time of the war, and I think it would have been very difficult, therefore, to go against him. So that was Mountbatten's line then in 1971. It wasn't till 1983, when Kenneth Rose wrote his biography of George V, that the truth came out. The woeful correspondence between Sam Fordham and the government was at last published in full. The Queen, our Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth, had gamely said, let him publish. But the Queen Mother didn't take it so well, apparently dropping Kenneth Rose from her lunch party list. This has been an ongoing issue. Several of my white Russian interviewees have taken me to task over the years. You British refused to help the Romanovs. You could have saved their lives. In fact, during our trip to St. Petersburg last year, the guide reminded me of the British failures. She gave me an accusing look before declaring, "What's too expensive?" She thought the decision had been made by the king because it was too expensive. Actually, the reasons for the king changing his mind are still puzzled over. Was it simply Sam Fordham putting the fear of God into him? Did he fear for his throne or even his life? Or was there a small part of him that simply feared a never-ending imperial tea party stretching into infinity with all the social awkwardnesses, etc.? Anyway, so that's kind of where the story ends, in some ways, regarding the book. But as it happens, just before the book was published, I was given a catalogue containing artwork by Prince Andrew Romanov, now aged 95 and living in California. He is the grandson of the Tsar's sister, Grand Duchess Ksenia. And Ksenia, who I haven't mentioned so far, she did live in the UK after the revolution as a guest of King George V. In the catalogue, the prince expresses his gratitude to the king for allowing his grandmother, that's Ksenia, and several of her six sons and their children, including him, obviously, to live at Windsor during the 20s and early 30s. But he also makes it clear that George's generosity rarely extended to actually consorting with his newly impoverished cousins. The two royal families had almost nothing to do with each other, and this is in the 20s, don't forget, in the early 30s. Prince Andrew's artworks amount to a sort of mini autobiography, I would say. He has drawn and painted scenes from his childhood, shrunk them, then mounted them on painted frames. Each picture, or shrinky dink, as he calls them, has an accompanying text and several focus on his years at Frogmore in Windsor. He grew up in a modest cottage just down the road from his cousin, the king, in the castle. In their quiet way, the pictures are rather damning. And here's the first one, where he ate Easter eggs. The prince vividly remembered when he and his siblings happily tucked into giant Easter eggs before realising that they'd been intended for the little princesses Elizabeth and Margaret down the road. They'd been wrongly delivered to Ksenia's house. The young Prince Andrew seemed to have had just one tea at the castle, during which he was graciously given permission to address his cousin as Auntie Mary. And there he is with Auntie Mary. Then, on another occasion, Andrew was at his garden gate. There he is, depicting himself as a little boy. When the king passed in a royal limousine, the young prince bowed and doffed his cap. The puzzled king rang later to ask who the little gentleman was, so he obviously wasn't very familiar with him. This one I particularly like because of the contrast in the dwellings. Here is a sort of slum with washing hung up outside for the Romanovs, and there is the castle up the lane. And then this is the last one. When the prince was cycling one day in the Windsor grounds, he met little Princess Elizabeth, who was 3 years younger than him. This would have been in the early 30s, as I said. He greeted her politely. "How do you do?" He normally spoke Russian, but he spoke to her in English. A severe call came later from the castle saying that Ksenia's grandchildren, the Romanov children, were not to walk in the private grounds when the British royal family was in residence. Years after the killings, King George V was still haunted by the fate of his Romanov cousins, and topping all the horrors came, all those years later, yet more social awkwardnesses. And that's the end of the talk. That's the end of what I'm going to say. But if you want to ask questions, you're quite welcome.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.